I think Jefferson gets blamed entirely for the Embargo Act, but it was super popular with, like, Congress, too.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, every act that ever got passed was popular with Congress. I always tell people that. I'm like,
right? Yeah. Hello and welcome back to The Buck Starts Here, the podcast that digs deep into the juicy stories, power plays, and wild twists that shape the presidencies of the United States. I'm Kyle, your casual history connoisseur, and I'm joined by Eric, brilliant loose cannon economist who gets the results. If you're still with us after last week's dive into Jefferson's character, first of all, thank you. And second, you know that today we get to take a deeper look at the policies of our third president's time in office. And from the little bit I've seen of the outline, I have a feeling that criticisms may not be done yet.
Oh, no. But Kyle, before you advance, can I give you a rousing story of mac and cheese and Thomas Jefferson?
Yes, please.
All right, so like with any good Thomas Jefferson story, it's an interesting story, and then it's dosed with a very heavy weight of the reality of the situation. So mac and cheese, like modern mac and cheese. Mac and cheese dates its history back, like, you know, it's a couple thousand years.
Mac and cheese?
Yeah, the idea of putting like cheese and bread and some sort of baking apparatus, But
okay, so that's the economist's look at food right there, and the economist sees all Mexican food as being the same dish, I'm sure, because they're all tortilla, cheese, and meat. Am I wrong?
Do we miss the forest or the trees? Yes, Kyle, do you agree with that?
saying cheese and breadcrumbs mixed together in a pot of rainwater is not mac and cheese.
Okay, sorry. That's fine. That's why I said modern mac and cheese. You're talking to somebody who literally can't eat mac and cheese.
Yeah, fair enough.
So modern mac and cheese, they're one of...
You want to know the real history of mac and cheese? Its origins trace back to cheese and pasta casseroles in medieval England. Thank you, Laura.
Yes. I just love that. It's like, I'm just going to wait on this trip. So that casserole style, right? Like we wouldn't consider like mac and cheese casserole, two different things, right? And so James Heming, who was an enslaved man. He was Sally Heming's brother.
Okay.
He was also Thomas Jefferson's wife's half-brother, and so was Sally. So Sally Heming's and James Heming's father was Tom Jefferson's father-in-law.
Okay, all right. So this might have been some learned behavior.
Yes, so just to give everybody an idea here, because this gets a little dark.
Yeah.
So Thomas Jefferson in 1784 travels over to be the U.S. Minister of France. We'll talk a little about the Revolution, but we'll go into his presidency. We all kind of know what Jefferson relatively did during that. And he was formally trained in French cuisine, and he actually became like a French chef. Like he's a full fledged chef, and he brought back that style of mac and cheese.
Thomas Jefferson presents Mary Berry.
He brings back that idea of mac and cheese, but he also brought back like the modern ice cream. The idea of modern, like how we look at ice cream now, and French whipped potatoes. James Heming's brought back.
Oh well, thank you, James Heming's.
Now let's get a little dark for a second. Thomas Jefferson loved mac and cheese. He actually served it at the White House when he was president, and he wanted to reward James for his work. It was like, I'll free you. And James Heming's like, that's great. But he goes, you have to train your brother how to make mac and cheese. And then kept his brother enslaved. Which would also be his like brother-in-law. Half-brother-in-law. Yeah. Yeah, so like pretty much
Can you imagine? Man, this whole freaking episode is just landmine after landmine.
Oh yeah, it's just, yep. That. Yep.
So now, mac and cheese is like basically the national dish of Canada.
Did not know that.
Really? You never heard of Kraft Dinner?
Is that a mac and cheese? The Bare Naked Ladies, they're from Canada, aren't they?
Yeah.
They sing, that's in their song, right?
Yeah, Kraft Dinner. That's just the box of mac and cheese. That's all that is.
That sounds, if I could eat that, that sounds
amazing. It's like the Canadian national dish. So is that why they burned down the White House? Because Jefferson was trying to steal their national dish?
Yes.
They used the timelines kind of line up around there. It wasn't that much further after.
Yeah, it was like 4 years afterwards. Yes, the Canadians burnt the White House down to heat up their water for mac and cheese. Right. I can't wait to get fact checked on that later. Yeah, somebody writes into the show. They're like, well, actually. The other thing Thomas Jefferson brought to the United States, or I should say made popular in the United States, was eating tomatoes. Yeah, a lot of Europeans and obviously came over here to the colonies, viewed tomatoes as poisonous.
Mm, I think I'd heard that before.
So there was a myth that they were part of the nightshade family.
Yeah, yeah.
crazy poisons. But what was actually happening is that a lot of people ate off pewter, which obviously has a pretty high lead content.
Oh, that's right.
The acidicness of tomatoes would give people kind of like acute lead poisoning. That's why I've had it described a few times, I'm sure. Like, anybody who's like a doctor wants to weigh in on like if acute lead poisoning is a thing. I'm sure it has to be, right? I
feel like it is, yeah.
And that mimicked food poisoning.
Huh.
So it was just way worse, because let me tell you what's worse than food poisoning. Lead exposure. So Thomas Jefferson, I don't want to say give him credit, because he shouldn't get credit for bringing
making his slaves cook him mac and cheese. No.
And then forcing the slave to train his brother so he could be free. Oh, God, that just feels horrible to say.
That, right there. Yes, yeah. That whole experience of being the guy getting trained just does not sound like...
Kyle, obviously, you know me for a long time. So you know that I'm actively trying not to be how I normally am when I discuss Jefferson. Very restrained right now.
Yes.
He should not be on Mount Washington. He shouldn't be on Mount Washington either. Mount Rushmore.
No. all right. So major economic policies. Where do you want to start out on here? Louisiana Purchase or anything before that?
Yeah, so he was appointed the Minister of France, which essentially meant he was like the ambassador. Imagine like an ambassador with like way more power, because back in the day, like, you didn't have quick communication. So you gave like your diplomats a lot more power to negotiate different things. Funny story, we covered it a little bit during the Barbary Coast, Barbary State Wars, where like it was essentially like negotiated peace. It was just like some random dude's like, I represent America, negotiated the end of the Barbary State War. that's hyperbole, but it's like actually not that much hyperbole. So he was in France from 1784 to 1789 when he was recalled to be Secretary of State. Now, in terms of economic policy, how much influence does a minister have? At this time point, a pretty good amount of influence. I mean, there's power and influence are obviously two different things. But he was it was funny because he fought with Hamilton a lot, and bleeding into being the Secretary of State, he fought with Hamilton. He hated Hamilton.
I'm kind of curious to know more about that. Like, why?
Do you want my opinion on why he hated Hamilton?
Because he wanted to be Hamilton? He was jealous?
Because Hamilton was born a poor, fatherless child in the Caribbean, and then came to the United States and built himself up to be one of the most influential men of the American Revolution, and came from, in Jefferson's eyes, bad stock. And why is this man? Alexander Hamilton proved to be actually not a bad general. But he led battles. And Jefferson fled the capital when the British invaded.
Wow.
Yeah. So I think there was a little bit, but I'm an aristocrat. I have all this education. You just have this, like, you know, kid who didn't have the best upbringing, moves here.
I did see the drunk history where they talked about then he finally let Hamilton lead a command. It was like towards the end of the war, and like I guess he was out in front of the lines, like whooping and hollering, going just hog wild.
Dude, could you imagine Powell just like, dude, what? Like, I'm gonna lead a battleship. And then he had all this influence on Washington, all his influence on Adams and throughout the country. And I think Jefferson didn't like that. Like, why should you listen to him? I look at all this that I know. And it's like, well, you know, at the end of the day, the United States would be in a horrible position if Hamilton never existed, because he pretty much built the modern economy, modern banking system from scratch. So he was fighting with him. But one of the things he was like fighting with Hamilton before this, and fighting with Adams, and pretty much fighting with a lot of his statesmen, I'd say, is he really wanted to continue relations with France. Like, really wanted France to be like our main trading partner. But you know, we don't share a common language. There's still a lot of fresh scars from the 7 Years' War, the French and Indian War. You know, you're still talking about certain treaties with France, especially in the western, Ohio area. There was a lot of challenges there.
And you're also, who's the maritime superpower of the world?
Yeah, right.
And who doesn't like France? Like, really? Like, you're going to be a maritime trading nation? You want to piss off the superpower of the world?
Right. And the and this is before the Quasi Wars, but the Quasi Wars didn't help. Like,
yeah.
So over there, he tries to maintain relations with them. He comes back to be Secretary of State. One of the first things that happens under Secretary of State is the United States announces its neutrality from the French Revolution.
And, yeah.
You know, pretty much after that, we kind of see the relationship, the trade relationship with France become less nation-to-nation trading and more, you know, just kind of
business-to-business.
Business to business. That's a great way to describe that, Kyle. So, I mean, it's interesting, but, you know, relatively in terms of economic impact was marginal. You have the XYZ mm-hmm. affair that we talked about under Jefferson and under George Washington.
Adams.
Under Adams and Washington. And
yeah.
So by this time, the United States is soured on air. They don't really want to continue this. They don't really want to continue this type of trade. And what's an important thing to remember about Jefferson during this time period is this is the man who was on the Committee of Five that drafted the Constitution. I mean, he wrote it. He actually wrote it in like a hotel room, like started writing it in a hotel room prior. And then, you know, you had Adams and, you know, I want to name all the Committee of Five because right. Everybody knows Jefferson and Adams, but I feel like from a pure history standpoint, we should make sure we acknowledge the people who like wrote the Declaration of Independence.
On a history pod, yes, that's probably yes. appropriate.
Probably good. So he's on the Committee of Five with Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, Benjamin Franklin, Roger Sherman, we should definitely do a show on Roger Sherman's life. Fascinating dude. He's kind of like Forrest Gumpy a little bit of the entire situation.
It just shows up and everywhere.
he kind of does. and then Robert Livingston. So a little quick footnote. So he wrote the Declaration of Independence. A lot of it got changed by the Continental Congress at the time, which like kind of ticked off Jefferson, but he just kind of like rolled with it because like how do you argue with everybody? But that's kind of the way he viewed it. If he wrote something or he was the guy who...
Do we have the original still?
Actually, I don't think we do have the original.
That would be kind of interesting to see what the first draft looked like.
I was really hoping the first draft would be like when he wrote.
Yeah. That's what I was thinking. It starts off as like, you know, we should probably be free, but we could probably work towards that. And then by the end of it, it's like, to arms!
So prior to the Declaration of Independence, right, this is where Jefferson gets really interesting. Well, probably y'all remember, you know, if you, from school, we learned about like the Olive Branch Petition in 1775.
I don't think I learned about that one.
Yeah, this could be more of an obscure one. It could just me being like a weirdo when I was like a kid and being like, oh, I wonder what happened. So a year before the Declaration of Independence. So this is like just before, just after Lexington conquered. So the war's breaking off. The Bostonians are like, we're forming our own country. Like, join us, live free or die. Join us or join or die. Like, we're just like, we're doing this. You can join us or not. We don't care. God, I love living in this, growing up and living in this part of the country because we're just very open about how we're just like, yeah, let's start a war. What are you doing?
Philly has Rocky. You guys deserve Bruce Willis. Right. I feel.
What's the Massachusetts motto? Is through the sword we seek peace, but peace only under liberty. It's in Latin.
Yeah.
I like that.
That's pretty solid. Yeah, I like that.
But very accurate to our history.
It's a bit more poetic than Texas.
Yeah, I always say it's funny because that's our slogan. And then you got our boys to the north, New Hampshire, who's just live free or die. And I'm like, both kind of saying the same thing, but you have the Massachusetts, right. Very wordy in Latin. So yeah, so the Olive Branch Petition was, we like sent a letter to King George III and we're like, hey, we're sorry about this. We should like, this is how we should go forward. Maybe give us some autonomy and stuff like that. And Jefferson, it was written by this guy, John Dickinson. And Jefferson was like, no, I don't want to do this. He's like, this is stupid. We shouldn't do this. But in a more polite way. And they send it over to him. And what ends up... So I kind of like this. So they send it over to King George. King George rips it up. It was sent to King George. It was adopted July 6, 1775. So just to give you an idea, like how close is this to us declaring independence? And King George rejects it on August 23rd, 1775. And that was actually, this is funny. This is a little history thing here. Everybody thinks we made the Declaration of Independence and Britain declared war on us. It's not what happened. The Olive Branch petition was sent to King George III. King George read it. He didn't read it. He like threw it away. And declared that the colonies were in, quote, open rebellion. So the Declaration of Independence didn't start the American Revolution. The Olive Branch petition started it.
Huh.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting because it gets no love. Yeah.
Right?
But Thomas Jefferson's like, yo, I don't want to, like, I don't really believe in this. So he wanted to draft an argument. So he went to John Dickinson. And this is kind of cool because he went to somebody who wrote the opposite side of it and said, I want you to draft with me something called the Declaration of the Causes and Necessities of Taking Up Arms. And it was basically them telling the world, not England, but telling the world and their fellow colonists, like, hey, this is why we need to take up arms. And after that, it leads to the Declaration of Independence.
I think you'd call that inciting. What's the word for that? Laura, where are you at? What's the word for, like, insightful actions? Like, when you're trying to incite a rebellion? Fomenting. That's a good word.
Yeah,
fomenting. Yes. Yeah. It sounds like what the Aliens and Seditions Acts was written for.
But it was. They were just inciting this, like, provoking them. So this happens, like I mentioned earlier, you know, Jefferson's still the governor of Virginia, the, you know, state capital. Virginia gets attacked, he flees. Benedict Arnold, there was a couple different people who led it, but Benedict Arnold was like the general in charge of that assault. So he flees. It's like a lot, it's actually kind of controversial in history because he stuck around, he sent his family away, and he stuck around at the capital, but then he like escaped by a horse, and people are like, well, why get captured? That would have just made like a better bargaining point. Then some people are like, all the other founding fathers were like pretty willing to get captured if that's what it took.
He seemed like he wasn't interested in fighting.
Yeah. Yeah. I was going to say something else. Good person. So, obviously we win the American Revolution. He becomes pretty much builds the modern architecture of diplomatic relations with France after the American Revolution. Works pretty closely with Benjamin Franklin. But this largely falls apart after the American Revolution. And then we get to his time as Secretary of State, which has some pretty major economic portions to it. So he resigned as Secretary of State in 1793. So he didn't serve completely under Mr. Washington, which this is what everybody always talks about American politics. These people resigned, that people resigned. I'm like, dude, Thomas Jefferson resigned from George Washington's cabinet. That's about as, like,
right.
Seriously. kind of an interesting thing. So he was a fan. I wouldn't say he was a fan, but we talked about the Jay Treaty under Washington, which is pretty big for economic because it normalized relations with Britain. He was a big supporter of that. Maybe not the treaty itself, but that normalization, especially in the western part of the colonies. He did, throughout his time as Secretary of State, really try to push, you know, continued normalization with France. But the American Revolution, the French Revolution kind of ruined that. The destabilization of their government, I think, kind of led to there's nobody on the other side to negotiate with, and we wouldn't see the rise of Napoleon until later on. So obviously he was the Secretary of State when Napoleon rose to power. Kind of a cool thing under, and this was, even though he resigned in 1793, because things took so long during that period, you ended up with, I personally think, as that he influenced the Secretary of State, because it didn't get signed until 1795, but it was heavily negotiated under his term as Secretary of State. And in fairness to Jefferson, he was essentially the architect of it from a like lobbying at the DC level.
Mm-hmm.
And Pickney's Treaty of 1795, it was a normalization treaty with the Spanish. The Spanish call it the Treaty of San Lorenzo, which is actually, I think, the more common name. Huge economic implications. Some of those economic implications exist to today.
Like what?
The Mississippi River being free to transverse. I think that's a cool one. Yeah, I wouldn't have guessed that was a just the largest agrarian production area in the entire world free to negotiate. And that comes out of the Treaty of San Lorenzo. So what it did is Spain controlled like an insane amount of land in the United States and owned Florida at this point.
Right.
It also controlled the port of New Orleans. And what was happening is Americans were basically using...
Wait, Spain controlled New Orleans?
Yeah.
I didn't realize that.
Very bizarre, right?
Yeah.
If you go to New Orleans, there's a lot of weird architecture.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's and you'll be like, what the heck is... Like,
I guess that kind of explains it.
So Spain, you know, Spain was allied with France during this period, and you have this like falling out with France, right? And Spain started getting nervous because it saw this normalization between the colonies and the Brits. I think Spain was kind of like, hey, they were hoping the colonies would be more like a third party. They'd not kind of be non-aligned. I guess we call it non-aligned in today's world. Instead, it's like, dude, the war ends, and within 20 years, you're like essentially back to, you know, a very aggressive trade relationships. The colonies are becoming very wealthy. Spain's a dying empire at this point for all intents and purposes. The Spanish Empire would barely leg along into the 100 years.
Yeah, and I mean, I think trying to ally with Britain against France, like, didn't they lose like half their fleet during that war too? That pretty much probably put the nail in the coffin for them.
Yeah, they were very much on the ropes.
Yeah.
A lot of people say the end of the Spanish-American War was the end of the Spanish Empire. I mean, I don't think that's a bad argument.
No, no.
It was 100 years away. Yeah. And you got to think these empires had lasted for, I mean, Spain's empire was probably 300-400 years old at this point. Mm-hmm. It was negotiated by Thomas Pinckney, who was the U.S. envoy to Spain at the time. And it's really not one treaty. It's really like a bunch of separate treaties. But the big thing about it is that Spain was like, hey, U.S., we want to be friends with you. You're aligned with France. And France starts falling into all this turmoil. And so Spain's kind of like, hey, U.S., what are you going to do? Like, we see your neutrality pledge. All right, cool, but what are you going to do internally? And then the Jay Treaty happened in 1794. And Spain was like, wait, what are you doing here? What? Like, because at this point, Spain and England are kind of like the two still active powers, European powers, in this, unlike, let's think of like modern day North America. And so you have the British controlling large swaths of Canada, and you have the Spanish controlling large swaths of modern day Mexico. And Spanish territory ran all the way up, you know, probably to near modern day, I think it was like modern day Utah. It was very,
yeah, it was north. All the way up in there, and it ran all the way down to, like, you know, yeah, what, the Cape of Good Hope or Drake Passage, maybe
the Darien Gap,
yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, Kyle, you Lara lived up there. I'm sure there's a bunch of towns with Spanish names. Oh, that, yeah. You're like, oh.
Okay. San Javier Mission? What is that doing over here? Yeah.
Yeah, I think Santa Fe is like one of the oldest continuously settled areas of the United States because of that.
I could see that.
So, really interesting that Spain was like, oh my God, dude, what are you doing? You're settling with the Brits? You just fought a war with them. And they see their partner, France, on the ropes. So what does Spain do? Well, Spain's job is to protect Spain. And so they start restricting. This is crazy. Like, the Treaty of San Lorenzo is like, oh, what could have happened? No, it was already happening. So they started restricting trade on the Mississippi River from, like, states like Kentucky, Tennessee. Mm-hmm. So they weren't allowed to trade on there. There's no roads. There's no railroads. There's really no canals. You're essentially strangling the entire area's economy. So Spain kind of turned to the United States in the 1790s and was like, hey, you know, remember the French Revolution starts about 1789, and they see the U.S. negotiating the Jay Treaty. The Jay Treaty gets settled. So
they're also sitting there wondering, who the hell is this Jay guy, and can we borrow his negotiating skills?
I went on a rant recently, some of my buddies, about, like, we were talking about, like, weird moments in history that you wouldn't, like, think of, and everybody's like, you know, like, that gentleman in the Soviet Union who thought they saw an ICBM coming, and he was, like, refused to launch a counterstrike, or one of the submarines during the Cuban missile crisis, and I was like, Jay Treaty, and they're like, don't pick something before 1800, why are you picking that? And I was like, normalize our relationship with Britain. I feel like that was hugely important to our country not getting curb stopped, like, in its infancy.
Right.
Right? No, I'm just saying, like, if you didn't normalize those relationships, they were amassing troops and forts, like, on our border. Right. Like, what are you talking about? But I think one of the cool things about Spain was that Spain wasn't like, they were doing it punitively, don't get me wrong, but they understood the situation, and they were looking for more normalized relationships with the U.S. They wanted to understand how the U.S. is going to behave, because at this time, no colony had ever, like, no large colony has thrown out the world's most powerful military and still had all of its resources, a developed government, developed judicial system, and was amassing wealth again. Like, nobody knew what to do with that. Like, it's just these bunch of, like...
That's actually a great point. But normally after, basically, what was a civil war, right? Normally there's a long period of rebuilding, regrouping, new infrastructure has to go in. Like, it takes a long time to repair yourself from those types of events.
Yeah, the UN calls, so you're right, it's a civil war. If you win it, if the current regime wins it, it's a civil war. If the current regime loses it, it's a revolution.
Yeah.
But they're both the same wars.
Yep.
The UN refers to civil wars as development in reverse. Because you're breaking all the stuff you need.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, it never happened where it's like, oh, wait, the port of Boston, which was one of the largest ports in the world at the time, was completely it was pretty much unscathed. They never came back to Boston.
Right.
So you still have this huge, place, this huge economic engine. And don't forget, the rest of Europe has deforested itself, so you still have all this forest land.
Right.
The French are currently ripping themselves apart, so they're not using the Louisiana territory. So it's like, this is kind of the only guy you got here, too.
Right.
I mean, you got Canada, but Canada's pretty much locked up, for large portions of the year because of ice. It really is interesting how lucky we got the way the Revolutionary War went.
Yes.
So the Treaty of San Lorenzo gets signed, and it does under Jefferson. This is Jefferson's biggest. I would argue this is actually one of Jefferson's most important economic accomplishments of his entire political career, not just of his time as Secretary of State. Free navigation of the Mississippi River is granted to the U.S. Unrestricted travel, which exists to today.
Yeah.
An interesting caveat here, and this makes me I don't know if Jefferson knew what he was going to do, but set it up quite interesting for what he did years later than Louisiana Purchase. Not only was it to U.S. states, right? It was to any U.S. settler. That word is so important.
Oh,
settler.
So not just established, but anybody basically has rights to that then.
Yep. And so it didn't need to be renegotiated to the Louisiana Purchase. But most importantly to its trade, it gave something known as the right of deposit. And we would call the right of deposit a free port today, which is you could move your goods to the port of New Orleans and leave your stuff there, and then export it to a different country without having to pay any export fees, which is very, very, obviously that's very, very beneficial.
Yeah.
And it also, it fixed a lot of the boundaries. We actually didn't know where Florida ended or Florida began.
No, really?
Because, for like way too long of a period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And it set the northern border of Spanish Florida at the 31st parallel. So that's, think of it like that's where kind of ish the modern day panhandle is.
Another reason why maps are so important is you forget like how squishy and how blurry the lines of the actual defined areas are.
Yeah, and so it also gave the Spanish basically confirmed the U.S. right over Alabama and Mississippi, which I know we talked about.
No.
This is the same time the affairs going on with Georgia just selling Alabama. Very weird like situation here. So like, they said the 31st parallel. If you follow the 31st parallel, it goes over the Gulf regions, like the coastal regions of Alabama, Mississippi. So there's kind of like this little like awkwardness after it was signed. And they were like, hey, did you just take Alabama and Mississippi's port access?
Yeah. That explains why they got that little where it stops.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so like the U.S. and Spain were just like, oh, yeah, we didn't mean to do that in that way. Can we just... And it was like a handshake agreement afterwards. It was like... Spain was just like, oh, no. We did... That's weird. If we just turned, like, landlocked Alabama and Mississippi, we'll just... You guys want those two little appendages that kind of come down?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, we appreciate that. That wasn't, like, in the deal. Like, they weren't in it correctly.
I remember something about the Gadsden Purchase, the one that gave Arizona the, Tucson and, like, the last little bit of the southern area. You know how it got that weird kick up?
Yeah.
I was told that the surveyor who was supposed to be going out there drawing the lines for it was actually paid to detour there, because if he would have continued straight, then we would have had a port in Baja, and that would have just basically led to Mexico losing Baja eventually.
Yeah, it is weird they have Baja California.
Right?
That is a weird, like, why would you want that if you're like, oh, you have to go through a superpower to get, like...
But if we had port access into the Gulf of Baja, you think that they'd still have control of that land? I don't think so.
Oh, did you... Very valid point, Kyle.
Right.
Spoken like a Navy vet. No, we're not. And then the last one was this idea of it's called promise neutrality. And yeah, they basically were like, hey, can you not pay Native Americans to attack us? And the Spanish were like, if you don't pay Native Americans to attack us, and they're like, handshake? Like, all right.
deal.
Yeah, so that was the biggest economic thing under the Secretary of State. But yeah, he resigned because of Hamilton, by the way.
Really?
Yeah, he was very open about that. He was like, I hate Hamilton. I don't know why people listen to him. Boo. Boo, Hamilton, boo.
It's just like, you know, they call Adams cantankerous.
Yeah.
So are we going to talk about any of the stuff that happened during his presidency? Because I feel like we missed all that stuff. Still.
Oh, no. We're good with this. It's just his presidency. It's going to be wild. So nothing really major. I mean, there's a bunch of major stuff that happens while he's vice president, but he hates Adams. People liked him as vice president. The Senate did. He actually wrote the manual on how Parliament should conduct itself. But he just hates Alien Sedition Acts, works against Adams, ends up leaving.
Well, it makes sense he hates the Alien Sedition Acts because he was the one taking it. I think it was kind of directed a little bit towards some of the stuff he was doing.
Oh, no, it was directed at him. Yeah, completely. 100%. Yeah. But also, in fairness, you're undermining your boss. I don't know what you want from it.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Ooh, I am such an Adams apologist. Oh, at least I admit my biases. All right, so let's jump.
Yeah.
Let's, do you want to jump into this?
Well, I just want to get us back on track and start talking about something like the Louisiana Purchase. I don't want to go too much into the Lewis and Clark expedition because I think that'd make a great part four. I think we should do that as our part four and just focus heavily on that. So maybe we can skip those and just go straight to the Embargo Act. All right, unless you want to talk about Marbury versus Madison.
I mean, a little bit, because my boy John Adams. Nah, I mean, Marlboro versus Madison, it established judicial review, which is a huge thing in economics. It's a huge stabilizing force in the U.S. economy. For those who, you know, Marlboro versus Madison is the midnight judges under John Adams. He appointed a bunch of judges. Jefferson was like, no, you can't do that. Goes all the way up to the Supreme Court in a case called Marbury versus Madison. Yes, James Madison argued it. James Madison was was basically Jefferson's protege.
Mm-hmm.
Chief Justice John Marshall basically rules that the Supreme Court could strike down laws it deems unconstitutional and creates judicial review that is still in force today. I mean,
oh, so that's what defined the powers basically of the Supreme Court? I thought that was all part of the original documents.
No, not really. We didn't super know what the Supreme Court was supposed to do. I think we had an idea of what it was supposed to be, the final court in the land, but what does that mean?
Right.
Can a Supreme Court rule? Because, throw it out here, if the Supreme Court can change its interpretation of the Constitution, doesn't that mean it's changing the Constitution itself?
Yeah.
Yeah. That happened under Jefferson, still super important to today.
Right.
So Jefferson comes in, so Marbury versus Madison happens.
Oh, but wasn't he very critical of like the formation of the Navy? Wasn't he not happy about using the money or maybe was it budget considerations on his end? Or
yeah, so there was a phrase going around, millions in defense, not a penny in tribute.
Yeah, yeah.
Cause that we used to pay tribute to the Barbary States, all of them besides Morocco, because Thomas Jefferson actually went to Morocco and negotiated an agreement to not have them attack ships anymore.
Did he do that Morocco, with the Constitution behind him?
Listen, Morocco, this is going to be a great thing for you in 250 years. You're going to be very happy that you get to call us your oldest ally.
Right.
Trust me, this is a good investment for the people of Morocco. That's an interesting country. Morocco, just fascinating country. So, you know, he showed up, negotiated that, but the rest of the Barbary States are effectively under control of like the Ottoman Empire, so it's like hard to negotiate with them individually. Morocco's like independent. It's effectively independent.
I always got the impression the Barbary States were just kind of like a pirate kingdom. Like there wasn't really a person you can go talk to necessarily, but
no, they had sultans. I don't know if they called them sultans, but they had sultans. Okay. Yeah. Oh, they had dynasties too. Like
also it's more like one of the like Islamic regimes.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to use the term caliphate because I don't know if that's how would be called there, but it was an empire, certainly, absolutely. Yeah, it was fascinating because Jefferson, actually under Washington and through Adams is considered the father of the Navy because he signed it into law, but Jefferson was always frustrated with Adams because Adams never wanted to use the Navy, but Adams is like, yo man, I'm sinking all these like these French pirate ships in the Caribbean, so I don't want to like go over to England.
We have two and, like, ships, we don't need to fight in two oceans.
Yeah, and cool thing that happens, actually, we had a ship that got interned during this time period, and the Spain actually paid to free it. They actually like paid the tribute for it. Spain might be low key one of our early on good allies. Yeah. Like they liked us.
Seems like it.
Sorry, we took the Philippines from you. I bet. And Guam and Cuba. So Jefferson, so the day he gets into office, he gets a letter from one of the sultans, basically, like, you have to pay more tribute because they viewed every new government, every new president as a new government. Like if a king got deposed, mm-hmm. like a new dynasty came in. And so Jefferson was like, I'm going to send the Navy over there. So he just like sent the Navy with like the Marine Corps because he can deploy. This is actually established a precedent that the U.S. military, the U.S. president could send the Marine Corps without.
This is with the executive actions, approval. Not without the, yeah. They have like a certain period, right? The War Powers Act.
It's like 90 days.
But that was the War Powers Act that established that. Wasn't that something that came about because of Vietnam?
Because of Nixon. I think the War Powers like 1973 or something like that.
Yeah, okay.
But that's where the precedent for...
I see. War Power Act.
It's just always weird because they always like want to get rid of... After major wars, they always try and get rid of the Marine Corps. Like, it's always like this weird...
Right.
But now it's like... It's essentially just a second military. It's like...
We need them. Like the good military is what they are.
Yeah, it really is. It's like the president gets his own military. So he sends them over there. They proceed to... It's a whole... Like Stephen Decatur and all these like really famous people. I always recommend people... I know it sounds goofy... but it's actually a very well-researched podcast. The Fat Electrician does one on this. Just put together very well. Excellently, Nick, the guy who runs it, did an excellent job with it. It's just go watch it. He's hilarious, but he's very funny mixed with being just factually correct. But in terms of economics, that had some impact down the road. But like the main thing is the Embargo Act. And the reason I've been holding off and going directly to the Embargo Act is that it was... insane. It was...
Do I understand that right? And that he basically just embargoed everybody?
I don't even, like... Yeah, that's kind of what he... kind of? He, like, Uno reversed an embargo. He's like, we're gonna not trade with anybody. And the funniest, like, part about it to me is that there's a term for this in economics. It's called autarky, which is this, like...
Ah, the A-turkey.
A-turkey, yes. Yeah. He's like, I'm gonna be independent all on my own. And it's like... You can be, don't get me wrong. Like,
I thought it's that just was called isolationalism.
Yeah. Oh, it's like honestly even worse. Isolationism. Yeah. It's like isolationism, but you're gonna trip yourself beforehand.
I'm just gonna flip the power breaker before I go settle in for the night.
Yeah. So the reason I love this is because timeline. See, we look back in history and everything seems flat on one timeline, right?
Right.
So the reason they did the Embargo Act is because like Jefferson wanted to remain neutral in the Napoleonic Wars. Because he still loved France. He didn't like the Brits. And so the Brits were like, they enforced a naval blockade and they started pressing American sailors into the Navy, their Navy. So, all right, not great. That's kind of like what we ended up fighting the War of 1812 on. But then France came in and was like, no, you can't trade. Nobody's allowed to trade with England at all. And then what happens? You had the Chesapeake Leopard Affair in 1807.
Say leopard?
Leopard.
Okay, like the cat, not like the person with... I thought you were talking about lepers.
Oh, like people with the disease?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Two completely different things.
I recently found out there's still leopard colonies. So
yeah, there's interesting. One in Hawaii, isn't there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
France is basically saying you can't trade with anybody else, and then Jefferson's basically like, I'm taking my ball and going home.
Oh no! So you have the... This is very similar to the sinking of the Lusitania during pre World War One American engagement after the Suffolk Pledge. This is wild to me. Okay, so like this is what happened: the Brits send a warship as part of their blockade to America, and there's an American frigate named Chesapeake, and conducting naval exercises, doing trade, and the U.S. The Brits just attack it. It's not a trade ship, it's a frigate, and they end up killing a ton of troops and wounding sailors as part of it. And so Jefferson responds by going to Congress with... I don't want to say Jefferson went to Congress. I think Jefferson gets blamed entirely for the Embargo Act, but it was super popular with like Congress too.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, every act that ever got passed was popular with Congress. I always tell people that.
No, right? Like, right?
How to pass both houses. So, Congress passes this in December of 1807. It prohibited American ships from trading with foreign ports.
What was the point of that? Was the idea to say that you had to come to us to trade and we're just not going to send our ships out anymore? Or was the idea that we're just not going to trade with anybody anymore at all?
It is highly debated among like cleometricists, like economists who study history, what this event's goal was.
Right.
It doesn't make any sense. So if you listen to like, if you listen to historians, and I think you should, and this, I think you should listen to historians, full stop. But particularly in this case, historians were like, oh, it avoided direct conflict that Jefferson thought could harm the country. And he was hoping to use economic leverage to change Britain and France's policy towards
trade. It was a bluff. It was, we're not going to trade with anybody then until you guys sort your shit out.
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
But it's kind of like a kid going on a hunger strike.
Right.
Hoping that you eat less.
Yeah.
It's like, well, you don't really have a say in this. I can just get more food. So it just pissed everybody off. Like everywhere, all at once, everybody.
Yeah.
The Brits and the French didn't care. They were like, oh, we're already like at war. Like, oh, I'm sorry, I can't get more. What are you exporting to us? Cod? Like, oh sweet. Right. That's cool. Britain with its massive empire and France with its massive empire are both just like, all right, whatever. I mean, at this point, this is during the Napoleonic era. He's taken over like all of Europe. Like this is
yeah,
like,
right.
The guy who's invading Russia isn't worried about getting access to materials. Like, so that goes on for a little bit. Destroys the New England economy. I mean, just really. I mean, it hurt the whole U.S. economy, but crippled the New England economy.
You talk about seeing the economic footprints of things like years and decades and centuries past. Can you still see the effects of this one?
We largely recovered, but I do think it made the New England states very wary of being reliant on D.C. Like, mm-hmm. New England states, like Massachusetts, for example, is like a hyper self-resilient state in terms of like we financially contribute way more money than we receive in federal aid. You know, we have like our own ecosystem of pretty much everything you need. Yeah, so it destroys the New England economy. And the South hates it. The West hates it. Spain's probably just generally confused. Like, didn't you just sign like a... This is a foreign port.
Did you just get most favored trading nation with Britain?
Yeah, it's like, okay, so in the last 10 years, you negotiated tariff-less trading and free access to Mississippi and the free access to the Mississippi River, access to the New Orleans port.
Limited access to the Dutch Indies.
Yeah, and yeah, you get all that. And now Jefferson's like, how about this? Can't trade with anybody. It's like, what?
Somebody hold my nose while I sharpen this knife.
Yeah, it's like, dude, you're under the swivel chair. How are you this dumb? Baller.
It really does sound like a bluff, though.
It does, except it just destroyed the economy for like 3 years.
Yeah.
Fun random fact. Thomas Jefferson invented the swivel chair, brought it with him when he wrote the Declaration of Independence. Huh. That's I just think that's kind of a boss move for a man who doesn't have a lot of those in his life. Yeah, so it ends up being super unpopular. There was actually this fair Jefferson had. So remember, Jefferson was the first Democratic Republican to win office. And people thought the Federalist Party was, like, going to come back because this is so unpopular.
Right.
And, yeah, so...
Wait, was this his second term or first term that this happened?
Second term.
Second term. Okay. So he's already... He doesn't care at this... Well, no, because there's no precedent, really, as far as how many terms you can run for.
Though right? He was very open. He was going to stick to the two-term precedent set by Washington.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah, so he ends up kind of backing down on it quite quickly, but that's the thing about economic policy. Once you retract it takes a long time to
how long was it actually active then? How long was this embargo actually effective or be in effect, I should say?
Yeah, like 1809, like just as Jefferson started losing.
Years probably.
Yeah, just as Jefferson started not losing, I'm sorry, I shouldn't use the term losing, preparing to leave office. Remember, presidents didn't get sworn until like March.
Yeah,
he decided, he was like, I'm going to repeal this. I, to this day, don't know how Madison won being that close to Jefferson with, like, destroying the U.S. economy.
Yeah. I mean, what would you have done differently?
No, just were not there any
other?
It.
What was the other options? I mean, no, I mean, but you're worried about, you know, greater conflict after you just got out of one.
Does trade lead to cut? I don't mean this sarcastically. I'm actually curious about this. I wonder if trade does lead to conflict. Usually trade leads not to conflict.
No, here's how it does. It's when I trade with you and not with somebody else. If I trade with you but not France, then France gets pissed off because I'm now supplying their enemies, and then they come over and they put a stop to that.
I like that argument. So it's a very World War One, World War Two argument there.
It's very, yeah. I mean, just, it's childhood school ground. You share with somebody and not me, and then, you know, if you pick the wrong person, they're going to get up and push everybody over and try to take it for themselves.
So I think I looked at this a little different, because Kyle, I do agree with you. That's very much like why the, essentially why we had Pearl Harbor, was because of our lack of trade with Japan. Mm-hmm. I meant more like not trade, just keep trading with everybody.
Right. Yeah.
This wasn't,
I think it was just Europe got, World War One, World War Two, we really saw it explode, like the complex weaving of the agreements between different countries that, you know, were centuries in the makings on some of these. Trying to navigate that minefield with like who you can and can't trade with, I could see that being just, I could see somebody throwing up their hands and saying, we're just not going to trade with anyone.
Okay, Kyle, I very much, that makes much more sense to me. I do agree with that rationale. Is that you're looking at, see, this is me being an economist, and that's my problem here.
Right.
I'm looking at it as an economist whose goal is to grow GDP. And like, you're looking at it as a pragmatist, as somebody who's like, no, Eric, there are wars to be fought, and we're trying to avoid fighting said wars.
Yes. To me, flaunting wealth is one way to really piss off a lot of people, as we've learned in the past.
Yeah, I'm thinking that, like, this isn't a moral war. This isn't World War II, like, where it's like...
No.
It's just a bunch of Europeans fighting a European war that they've been doing for 700 years.
Exactly what we've been talking about throughout the whole theme. I think the theme of this series has been, like, people are still people.
Yeah.
No matter what year you're in, they're still going to act kind of the same way. Human tendencies are still... They're universal. Yeah. And the human tendency of... You have something I want, I'm going to go take it. It's been around for a while.
Yeah, and the Embargo Act was also kind of embarrassing on the international stage because...
Oh, I bet.
Yeah, a lot of countries were like, oh, the U.S. doesn't matter, has no economic power. Look, they removed themselves from the global economy and nobody cares.
Yeah, and they just tanked themselves. The only people who care are Americans.
And the fun, it was replaced with... so after it was repealed, they replaced it with another act called the Non-Intercourse Act. Hell of a name for religious.
That's the Protestant roots showing up, huh?
Yeah, right. Like, and it basically said, which allowed trade with nations other than Britain and France, but it didn't. None of that mattered.
So they were just trying to get rid of France and Britain and then trade with everybody else. Yeah. You see, that's the way you, if you were really worried about pissing off the two major powers, just don't trade with them, trade with everybody else.
Yeah, that's why the Embargo Act was so crazy to me. I'm like, you handled this the worst way possible.
But it kind of, I think it fits with this character, the character that we've kind of, the picture that you've built of Jefferson, like, I see that sort of action being likely.
Yeah, and the weirdest part, it also halted all imports.
Yeah, that's weird too.
Which I was like, kind of confused when I remember it, like,
but the wording of it is kind of interesting, too, saying that you can't trade in foreign ports, meaning that it sounds like almost like they're trying to put a loophole in there that France or Spain can send their ships here and make the purchases. We just can't bring it to you.
It's so bizarre to even get rid of imports on that, exactly for what you said, Kyle. It's an import. Right. It has to literally be in a non-foreign port.
Yes. Right.
So yeah, it didn't work. Neither did the Non-Intercourse Act work. And very bizarrely, what remedied all this was the War of 1812. Basically, like once the War of 1812 kicks off, I believe it's a treaty again that ended that war, kind of settled all this. But
it's funny how wars tend to fix economy issues.
Yeah, actually, I was like, well, South Korea is doing pretty
Great
well.
Depression, World War II.
So, but during this whole time, and this is talks about the contradiction of Thomas Jefferson, is he's, before he went into office, or as he's, you know, early in office, he's against all this federal spending on the military. He didn't really believe in a military at all. He thought it inhibits liberty. It inhibits liberties. It, you know, creates these, I don't even know how to describe it. He believed basically that it created these positions where presidents could become kings, but that's also weird because nobody had had elected presidents before. So how could you say there's a history of president? You had a general who led an army as president,
yeah.
And he didn't do that. And then
right.
Adams didn't do that.
No, sounds like it's it just sounds a lot of that. Like, here's how things I wish they worked, but they don't work that way. So I have to do things a little bit differently. That's like the justification for why he can't do things the way he believes that they should be in his head.
Yeah, and as he's simultaneously reducing the size of the military, he's also using
them to finish off the conflict with the Barbary States.
Yeah, and like I would argue that he pretty much fought the first war, like the first go out there. I mean, I don't know what you call the bar. I know they're called like we don't call it the Barbary Wars, but it was. Yeah, the Barbary
we never
Wars.
Landed troops over there. It was more like a naval conflict than anything, right?
Yeah, we landed a few troops. Like I think it was like Stephen Decatur helped overthrow one of the Barbary State leads, but it was mostly mercenaries.
We'll call that. Yeah, that would be a war then.
Yeah, I mean it's like a couple hundred troops. I think.
Yeah.
Do we call Granada or Panama like with their wars? Like no, but like I know what you're saying, Kyle. You're accurate in that description. It's more of a naval engagement.
It's more of a conflict than
Yeah, and it's funny because a lot of times Jefferson gets credited being like the first Democratic. Like a lot of the Democratic Party look at Jefferson, which is funny if you throughout history. A lot of times people will look at Jackson as the first Democratic president, but that kind of has flip flopped in the first view. But Jefferson was actually like wicked anti-taxes, federal taxes. He repealed the whiskey tax, and a bunch of other federalist taxes that were put on during Adams and Washington's rule. And he to his personal life. He paid down almost all the national debt before he left office. Which
oh wow,
considering that he was accumulating debt,
that was a pretty substantial. That was a pretty substantial debt, too, as we learned the federal government assumed all the state's debts, too.
Yeah, and we were some spendy people.
We've always been. That hasn't changed yet, has it? we're kind of coming up on an hour here. Is there anything else as far as economic policies or things you want to touch on?
His return to Monticello and selling his private library to Congress after it was burnt down in the War of 1812.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's right. He started the whole trend of presidential libraries, right?
Yeah, sold it for about $1 million in today's money. I have this weird thing. I was curious how much presidents made back then. Presidents made, in today's dollars, $1 million a year.
They didn't get a whole lot of raises.
Yeah, it's only 6 raises. Like, they were paid
this... Now 400,000?
Yeah, 400,000. This is actually the lowest a presidents have ever been paid.
It's because of inflation.
Because of inflation.
Yeah.
Could you imagine that?
That's funny.
The first year, George Washington's first year, he was paid $25,000 per year. That's equivalent to $1.6 million today.
And you'd think there'd be a lot more estates left.
Yeah, what'd they do with
that's the case.
Money? Yeah,
it's expensive being king.
Yeah, it did, right? Yeah, but Pinckney's Treaty or San Lorenzo Treaty and the Embargo Act, I think, are the two most fascinating, it's the most interesting economic.
All right. Well, I think that's probably a good place to put a pin in it for today. I went a little bit over, but man, sometimes there's a lot of stuff you want to cover, huh? So I think next week we'll start taking a look at some of the other notable events that happened during Jefferson's legacy. In the meantime, we want to hear from you. What do you think about the effectiveness of his terms? Was the Embargo Act of, what was that? Embargo Act of 1807, I don't know. What do I call it? The greatest blunder to date in the history of the United States?
Oh, yeah. By far that or Georgia selling Alabama. That's also kind of funny.
All right. So which of the two would you say is the...
The state sold another state. That's
the bigger black eye. Yeah. You can email us at buckstartsherepodcast@gmail.com or you visit the website at buckstartsherepodcast.com to stay up to date. We'll see you all next week.